Accession number 30063, Reel 9.
Mr. Reed, Reel 9. So you've just joined the brigade in the dark, as you said, and you were just told inoffensively to get down, get your head down, sleep. Next morning, what happened to you?
Well, you were taken out. You're now part of the 7th Armoured Brigade. They are stand facing the Italian army, which is way, way further up in Cyrenaica, and you are now going to become one individual in the brigade to do the fighting. So that was good. The next thing we knew, when they got us sorted out, I was posted to the 3rd Hussars. That was merely to do the communications with them and any sort of fighting or anything else that should be done or was being done. That was the 3rd Hussars.
What can we talk about the 3rd Hussars at that point in time?
I've got it wrong there. That was before I joined the brigade. I'm getting mixed up a bit now. 7th Brigade, and from there I was posted to the 3rd Hussars. That's right. The 3rd Hussars. So we went up there and spent our time somewhere about 5-6 months on the desert fighting the war with the 3rd Hussars.
Now that was a tank unit?
That was a reconnaissance tank.
Reconnaissance. And what tank was it? Do you know the make of it?
Mark 6B. Three-man crew, Mark 6Bs. That's it, with two machine guns on.
So it was a light vehicle, really, armoured vehicle.
It was a tank as we know it, with tracks on, tank tracks on, tillers instead of steering wheels, and that was about the sum and substance of it. So what it was used for mainly was reconnaissance, seeing where they were, and letting the larger tanks go. So the larger tanks used to come up and they would be with us. And they would then go into action as and when required. We would be there alongside them, maybe on a flank and biting them from that side. So this is the scenario of all these tank things, and it lasted for about 6 months. And I think you mentioned earlier there, sometime during the tape, that the colonel, in a lapse of quietness of the 3rd Hussars, and they're still in the desert, say, cracking to me, having a word with me, "Hello son, how are you?" This, that, the other. "When did you last have a leave?" "Haven't had one." "What, do you mean to tell me you've been up here 6 months, you haven't had a leave?" "No." "Right, okay. So, fix that up with him, get somebody from down there, down at Brigade Headquarters. Get them up here and get these two lads, get them away. Get them away on a fortnight's leave." And we were then, God knows how long, but we were then, got the leave fixed up. It was bloody getting down to Cairo, which was a hell of a job, because it was hundreds of miles away, and we had to go not by one lorry, but get lifts all the way down to Cairo, and eventually we got there. Had a good time, good leave. So we went back to the desert again.
We may as well, since you've mentioned Lee, we might as well deal with, you know, what you were seeing in Cairo. You went to Cairo. Where did you stay in the city?
In Cairo, we can only say it was a bed and breakfast. It wasn't very nice, but it was much better than what we'd been used to. We did have some food there, but not much. So we spent most of the time.
What were you doing then? What opportunities did that give you, being on leave? What activities did you get up to?
we just went to nightclubs, had rows with the military police, because we were so raw and not haven't been in contact with real people for so long, just the immediate sort of people in the desert. It was all sort of different, and we were good because we'd just come from the desert. We'd been, you haven't been up there, have you? All this sort of business. So, and sitting around in the cafes in Cairo, it was a great place, Cairo, for sitting in the cafes. Some of them were lovely, and just having the odd beer and things like that, and nothing to do, lovely. So we thoroughly enjoyed that. Yeah, thoroughly enjoyed it.
What was it like, how did you find the Egyptians?
Didn't care much for them. They didn't want to know. They would steal anything they could, given the opportunity. And they didn't think much of us either. Don't think so. But
did they pester you when you're on the street with trying to get you to buy things and take you to places?
No. No, not because we used to. We were rather wild then as well. We used to tell them where to go to, you know. And if for instance, they had bootblack boys walking along with a box. With a step on, and they would say, because your shoes are always dusty, though, your boots are dusty. It was definitely generally sandy dust. And you could have them clean 1 minute and still dusty the next minute. And they used to come around and say, well, clean your shoes for you. And we no. If they got too bad, we'd give them a clip along the ear. But that's as far as it got, I think. They didn't like the Egyptians at all. I think they were a crafty, thieving lot of devils, you know.
There'd be lots of rear troops, rear soldiers there. How'd you get on with those as you met them?
Not bad. Generally, not bad. We have, I can tell a story now about one fellow whose name, I think he might be dead now, I haven't seen him for years. Came from this part of the world, Mick Rose. Before the war, he was a rep for some of those to do his calling and things. And he went out abroad with us. Finished up in Mardi. And he was a crafty devil. He's a lovely bloke. But a crafty, what do you do? You don't want to do things like that, you know. And he said, when we got them on, he said, I'm not stopping here. I'm going back to England again. I'm not stopping here. And over a period of time, whenever the list came up for your posting up to the blue, as they call it, the desert, you used to have a wet towel.
I think we've got this. I think you've told me this story
that's
before.
It.
Yes.
Mm. Well, okay, yes. That's it. That was micro. I don't know why I branched off there.
What about your pay? Obviously, up in the desert and you wouldn't be getting pay, presumably.
That went to your credits. When you got back, you would go to whoever it was in the barracks and they would sort it out for you. And you'd get it immediately, no question.
So going back to Cairo, you would draw some money out.
Oh yes, £60. I can remember the amount now. £60, and things were cheap then in comparison to today. £60, and we could get all the drink we wanted and everything else, you know. And yes, we had a good time in Cairo.
Were you pestered by ladies of questionable?
No, I don't think we were. We might have pestered them in the nightclub. When I say a nightclub, a cabaret, you know, at night. And all the soldiers used to get there. And some of them had regular girlfriends there. And of course, we would think in terms of taking them home, the other one. And then there would be friction with her boyfriend, and scrap, the whole lot would go up, you know, in a bombshell. But they did have They did have, what do they call them? Did have a brothel there. Mm-hmm. Trying to think of the name of the street. Forgetting it, that's gone. It's but it was one street, complete, with the women. And the place used to be overrun with soldiers. And some of them, the old-timers, had worked it, so they got time off, and used to go and stay with them, and sleep with them, and eat with them. And and that was these casual folks from Cairo, you know, who had no intention of going anywhere else except home when they finished. So, yes, they wanted to, but they were scraggy-looking devils, you know. And, we'd always be well warned, take your cream and use it if you've got to. If you don't and you come back here with disease, you've had your chips.
And there must have been quite a lot of VD and...
There was VD all over the place. And some of them were happy to have it. And she said, look at this, you know. And they were quite happy. I was still on the young side. And said, what the bloody hell are they going? You know, they're going in there. I think, if I remember rightly, I don't know, maybe about 100 piastres, I think it was. We didn't have that money to spend anyway. You know, but they were there. And it's a whole street of them. The Burqa, that was the name of it. The Burqa. And the street was full of them. And they used to live there. In the same thing. The Australians were the lads there. They tore the place inside out.
I was going to ask you, you come across the Australians, and how did you get on with them?
They were all right. They were just wild. But they were all right. They recognised us for who we were. If there was friction between them, which I never saw really, they would have a bloody good battle, you know. And they wouldn't even think about slashing the gypos, that sort of style. Wouldn't even think about that at all. The gypos were there and they got in the way and they knocked them out of the way, the Aussies. But they were good fighters. They did very well. And the New Zealanders were the same.
You'd meet those as well, of course.
Oh, yeah. Very good. Very good troops in New Zealand. Very pro-British, strangely enough. Pro-British, very. Oh, to the 8th degree. They were excellent. Yeah.
I forgot to ask you, did you have flashes of emblems on your sleeves and so on to denote who you were with? Or?
Just down there was all signals. Just a blue one. And the... And we most of the time, we didn't have battle dress on anyway. We certainly never went into the territory where the fighting was taking place on the desert. We never had sort of, what do we call it again? The dress?
Battle dress and then the blouse and so on.
Battle dress, yeah. You know, we never had that.
Oh, so can we come back then to the 3rd Hussars that, on your first joining them? You've mentioned the vehicle you were working in. How was your little unit organised? Who was commanding, for example?
The adjutant.
Do you know his name? Do you remember his name?
No. No. I couldn't even begin to remember him.
So he was your direct superior and giving you your orders?
He was the adjutant who dealt with the... First and foremost, he was tank commander, if you like to put it that way, over two men. But you need someone to see where the tank is going. He was the tank commander. And he ran the administration of the right regiment, the regiment, in the front lines.
Do you know how the regiment was constituted?
A squadron, B squadron, C squadron.
And how many vehicles would be with a squadron?
10 with each squadron. And from there they got their sort of directions and requirements and everything else.
So what rank would command a squadron?
Sergeant, sergeant major, sergeant, anything over a sergeant, lieutenants, second lieutenants, whatever they were, all right away down the line. The colonel had his headquarters tank, and then there was A, B, and C squadron, and they were such that they were there, and they were in there in the desert for so long. I can only say now that it certainly grew on me, the desert. I never had to feel in the end, before I got leave, I just wasn't taking any notice of it. It had become a way of life, in everything. Going to the toilet, a way of going to in the desert, going to the toilet. You had the whole of the Western Desert to go to the toilet in. And it was really a way of life.
Were you still, did you still have your one stripe at this point in time when you first joined them?
Yes, no. I have your two stripes, eh? Yeah.
So you've got two stripes, yeah.
I was a corporal then.
And what were you allocated to, a squadron as a signaller or an individual tank?
Well, I was with headquarters and I was in the adjutant's tank. So I had the CO with his tank, and I'm not quite sure. I think he had his crew, two sergeants, which was quite a lot, you know. And I had, we had the adjutant, and me and the driver, Spotter. Now, Spotter was considered to be a good driver. Some of them were haywire sort of style, but Spotter was a good, who analysed what was in front of him. If I hit that, it's going to go up sort of style. And after that, there was sort of people taking the tank over, you know.
So you were in a tank, which is, as you said, was the adjutant's tank. Can you describe the inside of the tank? Because you've got, obviously, equipment, and you've got instruments, and you've got guns and so forth.
You've got the tank with a turret. And the turret held two machine guns and a radio for transmitting and receiving. That was the main things in the tank. It also had ammunition racks where you held your belt of ammunition for the two guns which were in there, two machine guns. One was a 303, which is the same as an ordinary hand rifle. The other one was a .5 anti-tank gun. Now, what they expected, 0.5, to knock out an anti-tank gun, was just expecting a bit too much, I think. But nevertheless, you tried. You had to. What it did do for you was give an impression that the tank was well armoured, because there used to be a big flame come out the tank nozzle when you fire this thing, the anti-tank rifle, and that created an impression of good. So also in the turret, there were two cupolas, what are known as cupolas, two holes, one to get in that side, one to get in that side. And once you're in, you could shoot the lid, and the lid, depending, you, if you weren't too big, would just be above your head up there. And you could look through a visor, just a slit in the wall of the tank. You couldn't see much out there. So, mainly, most of the time, except maybe when you were being strafed by aircraft, the cupola lids were open to give you some sort of freedom, whatever it was. You had a 360-degree travel on a turret on the tank. And I said you couldn't see much, but you could move it around. Now, this wasn't powered at all. The turret wasn't powered. The only power it got was from your arm, because it had a wheel here. And as you turned this, so the turret went gradually went gradually round, and eventually, of course, whoever was looking at you so sort of had a good laugh and just got out the way. But that was the tank.
The radio, was it an efficient radio?
It was a good radio, mm. One at all. It was about 14, 15 inches square and maybe about 3 feet long. And you could transmit with that, you could receive with that, and you could transmit, oh, quite a good distance, miles, you know.
I was going to ask what range it had.
I think it was the number 9 set. I think it had a good range. I wouldn't like it. It certainly covered the whole of the regiment and going back to support troops and things like that. It was built for the tanks themselves, for close unit work. But beyond that, you could get a bigger distance. I'll come on to the wireless things later with the SAS. They were entirely different. They were beginning to grow up then and get stuff from America on a lend-lease plan.
So you're sitting on your little seat in front of this radio.
The seat was a little round stool, screwed, so you could turn it up or turn it down. On the left-hand side, there used to be the guns coming down your right-hand shoulder, and you worked from there. On the other side, there used to be a seat which is higher, because the commander had to keep, when you were doing anything, he had to keep watch of what was going on. And it was also almost impossible to see out of this little slit what was going on behind you, sort of the side of you. Almost impossible. So you've got the commander in there with the guns on the left, and he could shoot his .5 if he wanted, and I could shoot my .303 when I wanted, so it could take those two up. The radio, I did everything with the radio and got everything through and what was happening and what wasn't happening. So they were rather dependent upon these fellas who were with the earphones on.
So you've got this this piece of this radio in front of you. How was it manipulated? What did it look like looking at it?
It was at the back of us to begin with. Always, there was room for the back. There was two sections, very, very good, solid, strongly built radio. They went off periodically, they went haywire, but normally not too bad. And they would be on there, and we set the frequencies.
How was that done?
That was done by the radio on the dials. Say if you wanted a dial of 700 megacycles, whatever it was, you could turn it up there and press a button and lock it in. So that when you went, all you had to do when you were in action, or when you were using it, you had a key to lift up and put down. That was all. And that was very strong. And if you put it up, you're transmitting. If you put it down, you're receiving. So that's once you got it all set up and locked. Now the frequency on all the tanks had to be on the same loop, because the commander, the colonel, or the commanders, whoever, may want the tank to go over there behind him and shoot him up. So all they had to do was put the switch up and say, get across there and sort that bugger out, you know. So,
you would have to have, presumably, also some training on how to keep it going, if it's for putting faults right. And how deep was that knowledge?
I had all that training. This was what our training was about. In Darlington, we had a number 9 set there, which is part of the tank, a number 9 set to go, and there were 6 in each tank, and you had to know what you were doing. They weren't very complicated, really. All you had to do was tune them in. Well, that was quite a thing. You had to get that right. Once you got that right, you're home and dry. So you can, without even looking at the thing, you could push your hand down and pull it up when you're looking around, sort of style. It had its good effects as well.
And did you carry spares for the radiator in the tank?
As much as we could. Just had a pocket watch on, screwed in, and that was on the tank, so your time was all set. Spare valves, the bigger valves and little valves, and we learned how to change the valves, but it didn't need much. And strange enough, the whole lot was okay, but when they started running, eventually they lost all those things. They lost a lot, you know. It was unfortunate, but the Germans just came at them like them and rolled them out of the way.
Did you work in codes on the radio? Was it?
No, it had to be. You didn't have time to decode or encode. There wasn't time to do it. You had to say, get across there bloody quick and get it done, you know, let's get out of it. Or stay where, you get across there, you over there, have a go there, get that one. And it used to be, you know, put your bloody thing on receive, you know. Naturally, we all got sort of hypertension. Very, very much so. You didn't know what was going to come at you. And once we'd seen the way these German tanks came at you and the guns they had, you suddenly realised you didn't have a chance.